Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Democratic State Representative Elaine Nekritz of Northbrook, an assistant Democratic leader in the chamber. Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Come on. It's Sunday morning. You've got other things you'd rather be doing.
No, nothing.
That's very kind of you to say. I wanted to have you on because now we have the session in a break, as it were, but largely over. We've got a budget. We've got a tax increase. But we also have the fact that you announced that you were going to be leaving the General Assembly. And I guess I'm kind of curious if all of the last 2.5 years and the impasse and the divisions and the splits have just, and you're not the only one that's stepping down, but whether it's just taking a toll on trying to do what you all were elected to do and wanted to do.
Certainly there's a lot of frustration, I think, that you hear from members about the way that government is functioning or not functioning right now, and what the impact that has on our own personal psyches and the body as a whole. For me, I've been there 15 years. That's a good long time. And I feel like it's time for me to step aside and bring in some fresh, new, energetic leadership.
But do you still plan on being involved in public service or politically active? Or
I'm not moving, so I still plan on being involved in local Democratic Party politics in my area. What my future holds, I don't really know. I don't have any concrete plans about, that I have another job to go to or another, specific thing that I'm going to be doing. I'm going to take my time a little bit and figure out what piques my interest.
Do you have a time frame for when you're stepping down?
I do not have a specific time frame. We're looking for someone as successor, and we're taking our time doing that. And by we, I mean it's really mostly the Democratic Party leaders that represent
the
district, the Democratic committeemen, yes.
I guess in this past week, we've seen a number of shakeups in the governor's administration as well as with his political team. And we've seen now that he's tapped the Illinois Policy Institute, the conservative right to libertarian leaning group, for a new chief of staff, various administration members. We also see my good longtime friend Mike Z, who was he was Rauner's first chief of staff and then went over to the political side. He's now decided to part ways with the governor and his campaign. I have to wonder if this doesn't foretell, if we thought there were battles before, if this doesn't only intensify the battles, given the agenda of the Illinois Policy Institute, some of the things that it's called for, proposing a budget with no new revenue in it, just cuts entirely. Other provisions that they've mentioned in the past, firing all the state workers, I think, and having them rehired so they don't have the pension protections. I believe that was one of their staff members wrote something like that. But with that kind of ideology going on, and that's the governor's direction going forward, it's still a Democratic-controlled legislature.
So those actions by the governor caused me some concern, and actually in terms of my own personal decision, not that I was rethinking it, but it made me feel pretty comfortable about my decision. I do have a lot of concerns about that direction. I read the Illinois Policy Institute budget proposal when it first came out and couldn't even believe that was a serious proposal, in that they would completely underfund pensions, which is the very action that's gotten us into the mess that we're in with our pension systems in the first place, and slashing higher education. And if you talk to folks from Eastern Illinois University and Western Illinois University, those communities are struggling. They've got vacant storefronts. Professors are leaving. Students are leaving. It's just devastating those communities. And so I don't see how. I just don't see how the Illinois Policy Institute's proposal for the budget was at all a serious proposal. So that kind of ideology, I think, does just create even more division with the democratically controlled General Assembly and does not bode well for the next year and a half for the functioning of government.
Well, and there were even things that they proposed, like shifting pension costs onto local school districts at the same time that we're talking about a property tax freeze. And, you know, everybody talks that game about education. It's the number one priority. But when you see these kind of contrarian ideas being floated, and, of course, being against property tax increases, freezing property tax, you know, that's a, everybody, it's a magic bullet, right?
Everybody wants. Very popular, yes.
I mean, I do see the legislature and Democrats in particular knowing that the way the governor has kept talking about this property tax freeze as a political driver, that there probably will have to be something that comes out of the General Assembly.
And I think Democrats are for controlling property taxes as well. The question is whether you limit the ability of your locally elected boards to provide the services that the constituents may be demanding by taking action in Springfield, or do we leave that up to the locals? And I understand that's a very difficult and delicate balance, but it is, you know, it is something that we have to think about in Springfield before just imposing a one-size-fits-all property tax freeze forever, which is what the governor had proposed, for 4 years, which is what he was asking for, or for something what I would consider more reasonable as long a two-year property tax freeze.
Something so maybe we can get a base level adjustment of where we sit.
Well, one would like to think, but so far those, you know, every time I think we in the legislature, the democratically controlled legislature, propose something we think is a compromise, the goalposts get moved and we end up with gridlock.
And how is that going to get better? When
I don't think it gets better with these new staffers coming in. If it's possible to get worse, it looks like it could get worse to me. And that's, I just, every day I wake up and I think, oh, it can't get worse. And somehow it does.
Well, and frankly, that's what I wondered about because they are a very polarizing force. They're also have been politically active through their political action arm. And certainly follow through with the governor's mantra that it's all Mike Madigan's fault with everything. And I'm sure you even hear that in your district sometime.
Oh, absolutely, I do. And that, you know, I can certainly understand that, you know, Speaker Madigan's been there a very long time, and so a lot of these things have developed while he's been there. I appreciate that. But government is not by one person. Government involves a lot of people, including the governor and the Senate and all the agencies that state government functions through. So it's, you know, it would be easy if it was a silver bullet and it was just one person, but it's just much more complicated than that.
We're speaking with Democratic State Representative Elaine Nekritz of Northbrook. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio, joined by Democratic State Representative Elaine Nekritz of Northbrook. I wanted to ask you about the issue of pensions. You have always been very much involved in that issue, and of course we know that's one of the chief issues when it comes to budget making in the state, with the large percentage of money that has to go just to follow the prescribed amount that we're supposed to pay for our public employee pensions. Obviously, we saw the one pension bill that was that became law was overturned by the Illinois Supreme Court. So much talk about Senator John Cullerton and a model called consideration, where if you do this, you get that kind of thing. And I'm not sure, as presently constituted, that actually would follow what's known as consideration. And also just the fact that we're basing, you know, in looking at that as a way forward, we're basing it on a hopeful footnote from that Supreme Court opinion. I'm just wondering, where do you see things going as far as the pension issue?
It is a major driver of the cost of running government right now, and will continue to do so. I think as the pension systems, the state pension systems, take a look around and see whether they're the interest rate that they're using to calculate
their rate
future
of returns,
their expected rate of return, is they need to continue to lower that. That then increases the burden on the state, and I think you'll see more of that. So there's going to continue to be pressure put on the budget by the pension systems. We did take some action as part of the bipartisan budget that just occurred a week ago, a week and a half ago, to try to adopt some of the governor's proposals to create a new tier of pension system benefits for new hires, to cost shift a little bit onto some of the local units of government. So those were the governor's ideas that we adopted and made part of our plan. They have some impact around the margins on the pension payment, but they're not terribly significant. Not that we should, you know, turn up our nose at anything, but it isn't a silver bullet again or a solution to the problem. And to my mind, basically, the Supreme Court, when they issued their opinion, told the legislature to go find a way to pay for it. So we are finding that way to pay for it. It's hard. It will continue to be hard for a generation or a generation and a half, but we will be able to work our way out of it, given the fact that we do have different benefit plans
now,
and much less.
It's almost a matter of attrition.
It is a matter of attrition. That's exactly right. And so for the next 25 years, as the new pension benefits come into greater play, we'll see more and more relief.
Well, and we had been talking about, for example, the Policy Institute, where they've just recommended that everybody go into a 401k style plan, which, of course, the courts would not allow that.
Courts would definitely not allow us to do that for those that are currently in the system.
And two, you still need to have workers contribute to the system to help fund the system.
Correct. And the actuaries and the pension systems are very clear about the fact that they need those ongoing income and resources in order to keep the systems as stable as they can.
I wanted to ask you about some legislation that you were very much involved with, which involved the issue of criminal record expungement. And, you know, we have seen this trend, you know, nationally too, of, you know, what's really the cost of incarceration, what's really the cost of denying economic opportunity, you know, what's the belief in second chances, as it were. And I guess maybe you can tell us about what this legislation does.
This is the third year in a row that I've had the pleasure of working with President Preckwinkle on some juvenile justice reform issues. And the latest one had to do with expunging of juvenile records and actually also the confidentiality of juvenile records. Now, we all think that since Jane Addams instituted the juvenile justice system here in Illinois, that those records are intended to be and are confidential. And there was some research done to demonstrate that, in fact, they're not very confidential, and they're coming back to haunt a lot of kids who committed, either were simply arrested and never charged, or even if they were charged and did some time
adjudicated,
those records were very public and causing them difficulties with jobs and housing, all the things that you mentioned. So we tried to reinstitute the confidentiality of those records and to make it very clear that they are to be kept confidential and that there are penalties if you intentionally disclose those records. And secondly, when you get to be at a certain period of time after the arrest or after your adjudication, you will be automatically expunged. You don't have to go before a court. You don't have to pay a fee.
And I think
you just get automatically expunged.
And I think that's a significant matter because in the past, that's always been the issue of the onus of the individual to have to then take court action.
And if you're 19, 20, 21 years old and you're not a lawyer, which obviously we would not be, you know, how do you know the process? How do you come up with the fee in order to make the payment to get it done? How do you find a lawyer to help you? There's a whole bunch of barriers to that. And again, those just create further barriers for moving on with your life.
I know, too, about in cases that are dismissed, too, that there would be an expungement.
There would be. And so if you're there were plenty of cases where you just would be arrested, there would be no charge, and yet that arrest record would follow you. And that seems to me to be particularly egregious. If you've never been found guilty of anything, why should we be saddling you with an arrest record that causes an employer some concern, a landlord some concern? We just need to get rid of that.
So with and this is, we're talking nonviolent offender issues.
Not necessarily. Okay. I mean, it could be something a little, you know, that and I'm no criminal law expert, so I can't tell you right now what, but it isn't just drug offenses. It might be a burglary. It might be something like that. And again, all the research would indicate that the brain isn't fully developed until you're about 24, 25 years old. You make a youthful mistake, we ought to give you a second chance. We ought to allow you to be able to redeem yourself and prove that, you know, and move ahead with your life.
And this is patterned after American Bar Association. This
it is
not
this is,
like a concocted.
Yes, this is not some crazy left-wing idea about criminal justice. This is it's pretty standard. And again, the confidentiality is really important, and that's something that I thought existed when, but the research shows that it does not.
So this stands where?
It is sitting on the governor's desk right now, and I don't have any indication whether he plans on signing it. I get sort of mixed signals from some of the advocates that worked on this, but we're always hopeful that
when it comes to criminal justice issues, he's been very active in that.
And it is one of the places where the Democratic legislature and Governor Rauner have agreed, and there's been a lot of progress made on this front. We have a lot more work to do, and I would hope that this would be one of the steps that he'd be willing to take.
Let's go back to legislature's on call and intends to take a look at the other agenda items that the governor had asked.
Well, the other agenda items, and we have one major budget item hanging out there.
And I wanted to get to that. And that is, of course, Senate Bill 1.
Correct.
That is the public schools school aid formula rewrite. And we've heard variously that he's going to veto it, or he might mandatorily veto it. And it basically comes down to the issue of there's money for Chicago Public Schools that exists in that bill that doesn't exist in the Republican version. Basically comes down to the hold harmless clause and how do you determine if you're going to hold a school district harmless, what gets included and what doesn't.
Correct, yes.
And the Democratic bill does include it, and that's the one that has passed both houses.
It has passed both houses, right.
And will soon be arriving on the governor's desk.
Yes.
Governor just promised the other day schools are going to open. I'm not so sure.
I'm not so sure either. And you know, unlike the budget where it was pretty clear that, you know, there were 11 Republicans that felt like that the chaos and the devastation that would occur as a result of the budget not passing was too much for the state to withstand. I don't know how that dynamic will play out with regard to schools. Now, certainly the chaos of schools not opening is a pretty significant item, but the politics of this in terms of it's playing out as the city of Chicago versus everybody else, I don't know how that politics is very different than the politics of the budget. And downstate versus upstate and so forth. So I don't have any solid predictions on how this one plays out or how it gets resolved.
If the schools don't open,
eek.
Who wears the jacket?
I don't really know. I would think that, you know, that
if there's a veto involved.
If there's a veto involved and we can't override the veto and it passed the House with the bare majority necessary in order for a bill to pass with one Republican vote. Can we find 11 more votes on that? It doesn't feel likely to me. And so I don't really know, but obviously the legislature passed a bill and it's, you know, if the governor refuses to sign it and to go along with the majority of the legislature, I think he could easily wear the jacket for that.
We'll stay tuned.
We'll stay tuned, exactly.
Democratic State Representative Elaine Nekritz from Northbrook, thank you so much for joining me this morning. And
thanks
I'll
again,
let
Rick.
You head off to that half marathon,
okay.
All right?
I will not be participating.
You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Up ahead on The Sunday Spin, we'll be speaking to Republican State Representative David McSweeney of Barrington Hills.